Hello, welcome to Literally from the North Shore, and thank you for tuning in. Today we will continue our reading of Three Men in a Boat by Jerome K. Jerome. It was published in 1889, became an instant success, and has never been out of print. Its popularity was such that the number of registered Thames boats went up 50% in the year following its publication, and it contributed significantly to the Thames becoming a tourist attraction. In its first 20 years alone, the book sold over 1 million copies worldwide. It has been adapted to films, TV and radio shows, stage plays, and a musical. Sometimes the title is extended to Three Men in a Boat, to say nothing of the dog. And as Montmorency is a significant character, it seems fitting. The book has been categorized as a comic travelogue, perhaps the first, and the writing style influenced many humorists and satirists in England and elsewhere. As our musical touchstone to accompany this reading, we will use Peter Dawson's rendition of Old Father Thames, recorded in 1933. There will be 17 episodes in this presentation, read to you by Bruce Carlson. Please join me now for episode 11 of Three Men in a Boat.
The people at the manor house did not wait to hear us talk. The landlady met us on the doorstep with the greeting that we were the 14th party she had turned away within the last hour and a half. As for our meek suggestions of stables, billiard rooms, or coal cellars, she laughed them all to scorn. All those nooks had been snatched up long ago. Did she know of any place in the whole village where they could shelter us for the night? Well, if you don't mind roughing it, she did not recommend it, mind, but there was a little beer shop half a mile down the road to Eton. We waited to hear no more. We caught up the hamper and the bags and the coats and the rugs and parcels and ran. The distance seemed more like a mile than a half mile, but we reached the place at last and rushed, panting, into the bar. The people at the beer shop were rude. They merely laughed at us. There were only 3 beds in the whole house, and they had 7 single gentlemen and 2 married couples sleeping there already. A kind-hearted bargeman, however, who happened to be in the tap room, thought we might try the grocer's next door to the Stag, and we went back. The grocer's was full. An old woman we met in the shop then kindly took us along with her for a quarter of a mile to a lady friend of hers who occasionally let rooms to gentlemen. This old woman walked very slowly, and we were 20 minutes getting to her lady friend's. She enlivened the journey by describing to us, as we trailed along, the various pains that she had in her back. Her lady friend's rooms were let. From there, we were recommended to number 27. Number 27 was full, and sent us on to 32, and 32 was full. Then we went back into the high road, and Harris sat down on the hamper and said he would go no further. He said it seemed a quiet spot, and he would like to die there. He requested George and me to kiss his mother for him, and tell all his relations that he forgave them and died happy. At that moment an angel came by in the disguise of a small boy, and I cannot think of any more effective disguise an angel could have assumed. With a can of something in one hand, and in the other something at the end of a string, which he let down on every flat stone he came across, and then pulled up again, this producing a peculiarly unattractive sound suggestive of suffering. We asked this heavenly messenger, as we discovered him afterwards to be, if he knew of any lonely house whose occupants were few and feeble, old ladies, paralyzed gentlemen preferred, who could be easily frightened into giving up their beds for the night to 3 desperate men. Or, if not this, could he recommend us to an empty pigsty, or a disused lime kiln, or anything of that sort? He did not know of any such place, at least not one handy, but he said that if we liked to come with him, his mother had a room to spare and could put us up for the night. We fell upon his neck there in the moonlight and blessed him, and it would have made a very beautiful picture if the boy himself had not been so overpowered by our emotion as to be unable to sustain himself under it, and sunk to the ground, letting us all down on top of him. Harris was so overcome with joy that he fainted, and had to seize the boy's can and half empty it before he could recover consciousness. And then he started off at a run, and left George and me to bring on the luggage. It was a little four-roomed cottage where the boy lived, and his motherhood soul gave us hot supper, and we ate it all, 5 pounds and a jam tart afterwards, and 2 pots of tea, and then we went to bed. There were 2 beds in the room. One was 2 feet 6 inches, truckle bed, and George and I slept in that and kept in by tying ourselves together with a sheet. And the other was a little boy's bed, and Harris had that all to himself. And we found him in the morning with 2 feet of bare legs sticking out at the bottom, and George and I used it to hang the towels on while we bathed. We were not so uppish about what sort of hotel we would have next time we came to Datchet. To return to our present trip, nothing exciting happened, and we tugged steadily on to a little below Monkey Island, where we drew up and lunched. We tackled the cold meat for lunch, and then we found that we had forgotten to bring any mustard. I don't think I've ever in my life before or since felt I wanted mustard as badly as I felt I wanted it then. I don't care for mustard as a rule, and it is very seldom that I take it at all, but I would have given worlds for it then. I don't know how many worlds there may be in the universe, but anyone who had brought me a spoonful of mustard at that precise moment could have had them all. I grow reckless like that when I want a thing and can't get it. Harris said he would have given worlds for mustard too. It would have been a good thing for anybody who had come up to that spot with a can of mustard. Then he would have been set up in worlds for the rest of his life. But there, I dare say both Harris and I would have tried to back out of the bargain after we had got the mustard. One makes these extravagant offers in moments of excitement, but of course when one comes to think of it, one sees how absurdly out of proportion they are with the value of the required article. I heard a man, going up a mountain in Switzerland, once say he would give worlds for a glass of beer, and when he came to a little shanty there they kept it, he kicked up a most fearful row because they charged him 5 francs for a bottle of Bass. He said it was a scandalous imposition, and he wrote to the Times about it. It cast a gloom over the boat, there being no mustard. We sat in silence. Existence seemed hollow and uninteresting. We thought of the happy days of childhood and sighed. We brightened up a bit, however, over the apple tart, and when George drew out a tin of pineapple from the bottom of the hamper and rolled it into the middle of the boat, we felt that life was worth living after all. We are very fond of pineapple, all 3 of us. We looked at the picture on the tin. We thought of the juice. We smiled at one another, and Harris got a spoon ready. Then we looked for a knife to open the tin with. We turned out everything in the hamper. We turned out the bags. We pulled up the boards at the bottom of the boat. We took everything out onto the bank and shook it. There was no tin opener to be found. Then Harris tried to open the tin with a pocket knife and broke the knife and cut himself badly. And George tried a pair of scissors, and the scissors flew up and nearly put his eye out. While they were dressing their wounds, I tried to make a hole in the thing with a spiky end of the hitcher, and the hitcher slipped and jerked me out between the boat and the bank into 2 feet of muddy water, and the tin rolled over uninjured and broke a teacup. Then we all got mad. We took that tin out on the bank, and Harris went up into a field and got a big sharp stone, and I went back into the boat and brought out the mast, and George held the tin, and Harris held the sharp end of the stone against the top of it, and I took the mast and poised it high up in the air and gathered all my strength and brought it down. It was George's straw hat that saved his life that day. He keeps that hat now, what is left of it, and of a winter's evening, when the pipes are lit and the boys are telling stretchers about the dangers they have passed through, George brings it down and shows it round, and the stirring tale is told anew, with a fresh exaggeration every time. Harris got off with merely a flesh wound. After that, I took the tin off myself and hammered at it with the mast till I was worn out and sick at heart, whereupon Harris took it in hand. He beat it out flat. We beat it back square. We battered it into every form known to geometry, but we could not make a hole in it. Then George went at it and knocked it into shape, so strange, so weird, so unearthly in its wild hideousness, that he got frightened and threw away the mast. Then we all three sat around it on the grass and looked at it. There was one great dent across the top that had the appearance of a mocking grin. It drove us furious, so that Harris rushed at the thing and caught it up and flung it far into the middle of the river, and as it sank, we hurled our curses at it, and we got into the boat and rowed away from the spot and never paused till we reached Maidenhead. Maidenhead itself is too snobby to be pleasant. It is the haunt of the river swell and his overdressed female companion. It is the town of showy hotels, patronized chiefly by dudes and ballet girls. It is the witch's kitchen from which to go forth those demons of the river, steam launches. The London Journal Duke always has his little place at Maidenhead, and the heroine of the 3-volume novel always dines there when she goes out on the spree with somebody or other. We went through Maidenhead quickly, and then eased up and took leisurely that grand reach beyond Bolter's and Cookham Lock. Clevedon Woods still wore their dainty dress of spring and rose up from the water's edge in one long harmony of blended shades of fairy green. In its unbroken loveliness, this is, perhaps, the sweetest stretch of all the river, and lingeringly we slowly drew our little boat away from its deep peace. We pulled up in the backwater just below Cookham and had tea, and when we were through the lock, it was evening. A stiffish breeze had sprung up in our favor for a wonder, for, as a rule on the river, the wind is always dead against you whatever way you go. It is against you in the morning when you start for a day's trip, and you pull a long distance, thinking how easy it will be to come back with a sail. Then, after tea, the wind veers round, and you have to pull hard into its teeth all the way home. When you forget to take the sail at all, then the wind is consistently in your favor both ways. But there, this world is only probation, and man was born to trouble as the sparks fly upward. This evening, however, they had evidently made a mistake, and had put the wind round at our back instead of in our face. We kept very quiet about it, and got the sail up quickly before they found it out, and then we spread ourselves about the boat in thoughtful attitudes, and the sail bellied out and strained and grumbled at the mast, and the boat flew. I steered. There is no more thrilling sensation I know of than sailing, It comes as near to flying as man has got to yet except in dreams. The wings of the rushing wind seem to be bearing you onward, you know not where. You are no longer the slow, plodding, puny thing of clay creeping tortuously upon the ground. You are part of nature. Your heart is throbbing against hers. Her glorious arms are round you, raising you up against her heart. Your spirit is at one with hers. Your limbs grow light. The voices of the air are singing to you. The earth seems far away and little, and the clouds, so close above your head, are brothers, and you stretch your arms to them. We had the river to ourselves, except that, far in the distance, we could see a fishing punt, moored in midstream, on which three fishermen sat. And we skimmed over the water, and past the wooded banks, and no one spoke. I was steering. As we drew nearer, we could see that the three men fishing seemed old and solemn-looking men. They sat on three chairs in the punt and watched intently their lines, and the red sunset drew a mystic light upon the waters and tinged with fire the towering woods and made a golden glory of the piled-up clouds. It was an hour of deep enchantment, of ecstatic hope and longing. The little sail stood out against the purple sky. The gloaming lay around us, wrapping the world in rainbow shadows, and behind us crept the night. We seemed like knights of some old legend sailing across some mystic lake into the unknown realm of twilight, unto the land of the sunset. We did not go into the realm of twilight. We went slap into that punt, where those three old men were fishing. We did not know what had happened at first because the sail shut out the view, but from the nature of the language that rose up upon the evening air, we gathered that we had come into the neighborhood of human beings, and that they were vexed and discontented. Harris let the sail down, and then we saw what had happened. We had knocked those three old gentlemen off their chairs into a general heap at the bottom of the boat, and they were now slowly and painfully sorting themselves out from each other and picking fish off themselves. And as they worked, they cursed us not with a common cursory curse, but with long and carefully thought out comprehensive curses that embraced the whole of our career and went away into the distant future, and included all our relations and covered everything connected with us. Good, substantial curses. Harris told them they ought to be grateful for a little excitement sitting there fishing all day, and he also said that he was shocked and grieved to hear men their age give way to temper so, but it did not do any good. George said he would steer after that. He said a mind like mine ought not be expected to give itself away in steering boats. Better let a mere commonplace human being see after that boat before we jolly well all get drowned. And he took the lines and brought us up to Marlow. And at Marlow we left the boat by the bridge and went and put up for the night at the Crown. Chapter 13. Marlow is one of the pleasantest river centers I know of. It is a bustling, lively little town, not very picturesque on the whole, it is true, but there are many quaint nooks and corners to be found in it. Nevertheless, standing arches in the shattered bridge of time, over which our fancy travels back to the days when Marlow Manor owned Saxon Algar for its lord, ere conquering William ceased to give to Queen Matilda, ere it passed to the earls of Warwick, or the worldly wise Lord Paget, the counsellor of four successive sovereigns. There is lovely country round about it, too, if, after boating, you are fond of a walk, while the river itself is at its best here. Down to Cookham, past the quarry woods and the meadows is a lovely reach. Dear old quarry woods, with your narrow climbing paths and little winding glades, how scented to this hour you seem with memories of sunny summer days. How haunted are your shadowy vistas with the ghosts of laughing faces. How from your whispering leaves there softly fall the voices of long ago. From Marlow up to Sonning is even fairer yet. Grand old Bisham Abbey, whose stone walls have rung to the shouts of the Knights Templars, and which at one time was the home of Anne of Cleves, and at another of Queen Elizabeth, is passed on the right bank just half a mile above Marlow Bridge. Bisham Abbey is rich in melodramatic properties. It contains a tapestry bedchamber and a secret room hid high up in the thick walls. The ghost of the Lady Holy, who beat her little boy to death, still walks there at night, trying to wash its ghostly hands clean in a ghostly basin. Warwick, the kingmaker, rests there, careless now about such trivial things as earthly kings and earthly kingdoms. And Salisbury, who did good service at Poitiers. Just before you come to the abbey and right on the river bank is Bisham Church, and, perhaps, if any tombs are worth inspecting, they are the tombs and monuments in Bisham Church. It was while floating in his boat under the Bisham beeches that Shelley, who was then living at Marlow, you can see his house now in West Street, composed The Revolt of Islam. By Hurley Weir, a little higher up, I have often thought that I could stay a month without having sufficient time to drink in all the beauty of the scene. The village of Hurley, 5 minutes' walk from the lock, is as old a little spot as there is on the river, dating as it does, to quote the quaint phraseology of those dim days, from the times of King Siebert and King Offa. Just west past the Weir, going up, is Danes Field, where the invading Danes once encamped during their march to Gloucestershire. And a little farther still, nestling by a sweet corner of the stream, is what is left of Mendenham Abbey. The famous Mendenham Monks, or Hellfire Club, as they were commonly called, and of whom the notorious Wilkes was a member, were a fraternity whose motto was, "Do as you please," and that invitation still stands over the ruined doorway of the abbey. Many years before this bogus abbey, with its congregation of irreverent jesters, was founded, there stood upon the same spot a monastery of a sterner kind, whose monks were of a somewhat different type to the revelers that were to follow them 500 years afterwards. The Cistercian monks, whose abbey stood there in the 13th century, wore no clothes but rough tunics and cowls, and ate no flesh, nor fish, nor eggs. They lay upon the straw, and they rose at midnight to mass. They spent the day in labor, reading, and prayer, and over all their lives there fell a silence as of death, for no one spoke. A grim fraternity, passing grim lives in that sweet spot that God had made so bright. Strange that nature's voices all around them, the soft singing of waters, the whispering of the river grass, the music of the rustling wind, should not have taught them a truer meaning of life than this. They listened there through the long days in silence, waiting for a voice from heaven, and all day long, and through the solemn night, it spoke to them in myriad tones, and they heard it not. From Mendenham to sweet Hambleton Lock, the river is full of peaceful beauty, but after it passes Greenlands, the rather uninteresting-looking river residence of my newsagent, a quiet, unassuming old gentleman, who may often be met with about these regions during the summer months, sculling himself along in easy, vigorous style, or chatting genially to some old lawkeeper as he passes through until well the other side of Henley. It is somewhat bare and dull. We got up tolerably early on Monday morning at Marlow, and went for a bathe before breakfast, and coming back, Montmorency made an awful ass of himself. The only subject on which Montmorency and I have any serious difference of opinion is cats. I like cats. Montmorency does not. When I meet a cat, I say, "Poor pussy," and stop down and tickle the side of its head, and the cat sticks its tail in a rigid cast-iron manner, arches its back, and wipes its nose up against my trousers. And all is gentleness and peace. When Montmorency meets a cat, the whole street knows about it, and there is enough bad language wasted in 10 seconds to last an ordinary, respectable man all his life with care. I do not blame the dog, contenting myself as a rule with merely clouting his head or throwing stones at him, because I take it that is his nature. Fox terriers are born with about 4 times as much original sin in them as other dogs are, and it will take years and years of patient effort on the part of us Christians to bring about any appreciable reformation in the rowdiness of a fox terrier nature.
You have been listening to episode 11 of Three Men in a Boat by Jerome K. Jerome. Please remember that if you miss an episode, you can find it by going to our website, ktwh.org, and clicking on Programs, and then Literally from the North Shore on the drop-down list. Each week, we will post the episodes from the prior 2 weeks for you to catch up on. Please join me next time for episode 12 of Three Men in a Boat, here on Literally from the North Shore.
What does he know? What does he care? Nothing for you or me. Old Father Thames keeps rolling along down to the mighty sea. He never seems to worry, doesn't care for fortunes of fame. He never seems to hurry, but he gets there just the same. Kingdoms may come, kingdoms may go, whatever the end may be. All Father Thames keeps rolling along down to the mighty sea. The best way, a heaven best way, just try to be always kind. It doesn't matter what the rest say, you're bound to leave them far behind. It's your job to do your duty, be faithful to all your friends, for England and home and beauty, like old Father Thames. High in the hills, down in the lanes, happy and fancy free, old Father Thames keeps rolling on.